Rule 5. Do not let your children do anything that makes you dislike them. Actually, it's not okay. Recently, I watched a 3-year-old boy trail his mother and father slowly through a crowded airport. He was screaming violently at 5-second intervals. And more important, he was doing it voluntarily. He wasn't at the end of his tether. As a parent, I could tell from the tone. He was irritating his parents and hundreds of other people to gain attention. Maybe he needed something. But that was no way to get it, and his parents should have let him know that. You might object that perhaps they were worn out and jet-lagged after a long trip. But 30 seconds of carefully directed problem-solving would have brought the shameful episode to a halt. More thoughtful parents would not have let someone they truly cared for become the object of a crowd's contempt. I've also watched a couple, unable or unwilling to say no to their 2-year-old, obliged to follow closely behind him everywhere he went, every moment of what was supposed to be an enjoyable social visit, because he misbehaved so badly when not micromanaged that he could not be given a second of genuine freedom without risk. The desire of his parents to let their child act without correction on every impulse perversely produced precisely the opposite effect. They deprived him instead of every opportunity to engage in independent action. Because they did not dare to teach him what no means, he had no conception of the reasonable limits enabling maximal toddler autonomy. It was a classic example of too much chaos breeding too much order, and the inevitable reversal. I have, similarly, seen parents rendered unable to engage in adult conversation at a dinner party because their children, 4 and 5, dominated the social scene, eating the centers out of all the sliced bread, subjecting everyone to their juvenile tyranny, while mom and dad watched, embarrassed, and bereft of the ability to intervene. When my now adult daughter was a child, another child once hit her on the head with a metal toy truck. I watched that same child, 1 year later, viciously push his younger sister backwards over a fragile glass-surfaced coffee table. His mother picked him up immediately afterward, but not her frightened daughter, and told him in hushed tones not to do such things, while she patted him comfortingly in a manner clearly indicative of approval. She was out to produce a little god emperor of the universe. That's the unstated goal of many a mother, including many who consider themselves advocates for full gender equality. Such women will object vociferously to any command uttered by an adult male, but will trot off in seconds to make their progeny a peanut butter sandwich if he demands it while immersed self-importantly in a video game. The future mates of such boys have every reason to hate their mothers-in-law. Respect for women? That's for other boys, other men, not for their dear sons. Something of the same sort may underlie, in part, the preference for male children, seen most particularly in places such as India, Pakistan, and China, where sex-selective abortion is widely practiced. The Wikipedia entry for that practice attributes its existence to cultural norms favoring male over female children. I cite Wikipedia because it is collectively written and edited and, therefore, the perfect place to find accepted wisdom. But there's no evidence that such ideas are strictly cultural. There are plausible psychobiological reasons for the evolution of such an attitude, and they're not pretty from a modern egalitarian perspective. If circumstances force you to put all your eggs into one basket, so to speak, a son is a better bet by the strict standards of evolutionary logic, where the proliferation of your genes is all that matters. Why? Well, a reproductively successful daughter might gain you 8 or 9 children. The Holocaust survivor Yitta Schwartz, a star in this regard, had 3 generations of direct descendants who matched such performance. She was the ancestor of almost 2,000 people by the time of her death in 2010. But the sky is truly the limit with a reproductively successful son. Sex with multiple female partners is his ticket to exponential reproduction, given our species' practical limitation to single births. Rumor has it that the actor Warren Beatty and the athlete Wilt Chamberlain each bedded multiple thousands of women, something not unknown as well among rock stars. They didn't produce children in those numbers. Modern birth control limits that, but similar celebrity types in the past have done so. The forefather of the Qing dynasty, Giocanga, circa 1550, for example, is the male line ancestor of 1.5 million people in northeastern China. The medieval Yinan dynasty produced up to 3 million male descendants, localized mainly in northwestern Ireland and the U.S. through Irish emigration. And the king of them all, Genghis Khan, conqueror of much of Asia, is forefather of 8% of the men in Central Asia, 16 million male descendants, 34 generations later. So, from a deep biological perspective, there are reasons why parents might favor sons sufficiently to eliminate female fetuses, although I am not claiming direct causality, nor suggesting a lack of other, more culturally dependent reasons. Preferential treatment awarded a son during development might even help produce an attractive, well-rounded, confident man. This happened in the case of the father of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud, by his own account. A man who has been the indisputable favorite of his mother keeps for life the feeling of a conqueror, that confidence of success that often induces real success. Fair enough. But feeling of a conqueror can all too easily become actual conqueror. Genghis Khan's outstanding reproductive success certainly came at the cost of any success whatsoever for others, including the dead millions of Chinese, Persians, Russians, and Hungarians. Spoiling a son might therefore work well from the standpoint of the selfish gene, allowing the favored child's genes to replicate themselves in innumerable offspring, to use the evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins' famous expression. But it can make for a dark, painful spectacle in the here and now, and mutate into something indescribably dangerous. None of this means that all mothers favor all sons over their daughters, or that daughters are not sometimes favored over sons, or that fathers don't sometimes favor their sons. Other factors can clearly dominate. Sometimes, for example, unconscious hatred, sometimes not so unconscious either, overrides any concern a parent might have for any child, regardless of gender or personality or situation. I saw a 4-year-old boy allowed to go hungry on a regular basis. His nanny had been injured, and he was being cycled through the neighbors for temporary care. When his mother dropped him off at our house, she indicated that he wouldn't eat at all day. "That's okay," she said. It wasn't okay, in case that's not obvious. This was the same 4-year-old boy who clung to my wife for hours in absolute desperation and total commitment when she tenaciously, persistently, and mercifully managed to feed him an entire lunchtime meal, rewarding him throughout for his cooperation and refusing to let him fail. He started out with a closed mouth, sitting with all of us at the dining room table, my wife and I, our 2 kids, and 2 neighborhood kids we looked after during the day. She put the spoon in front of him, waiting patiently, persistently, while he moved his head back and forth, refusing at entry, using defensive methods typical of a recalcitrant and none too well-attended 2-year-old. She didn't let him fail. She patted him on the head every time he managed a mouthful, telling him sincerely that he was a good boy when he did so. She did think he was a good boy. He was a cute, damaged kid. 10, not too painful minutes later, he finished his meal. We were all watching intently. It was a drama of life and death. "Look," she said, holding up his bowl. "You finished all of it." This boy, who was standing in the corner voluntarily and unhappily when I first saw him, who wouldn't interact with the other kids, who frowned chronically, who wouldn't respond to me when I tickled and prodded him trying to get him to play. This boy broke immediately into a wide, radiant smile. Brought joy to everyone at the table. 20 years later, writing it down today, it still brings me to tears. Afterward, he followed my wife around like a puppy for the rest of the day, refusing to let her out of his sight. When she sat down, he jumped in her lap, cuddling in, opening himself back up to the world, searching desperately for the love he had been continually denied. Later in the day, but far too soon, his mother reappeared. She came down the stairs into the room we all occupied. "Oh, super mom," she uttered resentfully, seeing her son curled up in my wife's lap. Then she departed, black, murderous heart unchanged, doomed child in hand. She was a psychologist. The things you can see with even a single open eye. It's no wonder that people want to stay blind. Everybody hates arithmetic. My clinical clients frequently come to me to discuss their day-to-day familial problems. Such quotidian concerns are insidious. Their habitual and predictable occurrence makes them appear trivial. But that appearance of triviality is deceptive. It is the things that occur every single day that truly make up our lives. And time, spent the same way over and again, adds up at an alarming rate. One father recently spoke with me about the trouble he was having putting his son to sleep at night, a ritual that typically involved about 3/4 of an hour of fighting. We did the arithmetic. 45 minutes a day, 7 days a week. That's 300 minutes, or 5 hours a week. 5 hours for each of the 4 weeks of a month? That's 20 hours per month. 20 hours a month for 12 months is 240 hours a year. That's a month and a half of standard 40-hour work weeks. My client was spending a month and a half of work weeks per year fighting ineffectually and miserably with his son. Needless to say, both were suffering for it. No matter how good your intentions or how sweet and tolerant your temperament, you will not maintain good relations with someone you fight with for a month and a half of work weeks per year. Resentment will inevitably build. Even if it doesn't, all that wasted, unpleasant time could clearly be spent in more productive and useful and less stressful and more enjoyable activity. How are such situations to be understood? Where does the fault lie? In child or in parent? In nature or society? And what, if anything, is to be done? Some localize all such problems in the adult, whether in the parent or broader society. There are no bad children, such people think, only bad parents. When the idealized image of an unsullied child is brought to mind, this notion appears fully justified. The beauty, openness, joy, trust, and capacity for love characterizing children makes it easy to attribute full culpability to the adults on the scene. But such an attitude is dangerously and naively romantic. It's too one-sided in the case of parents granted a particularly difficult son or daughter. It's also not for the best that all human corruption is uncritically laid at society's feet. That conclusion merely displaces the problem back in time. It explains nothing and solves no problems. If society is corrupt, but not the individuals within it, then where did the corruption originate? How is it propagated? It's a one-sided, deeply ideological theory. Even more problematic is the insistence logically stemming from this presumption of social corruption that all individual problems, no matter how rare, must be solved by cultural restructuring, no matter how radical. Our society faces the increasing call to deconstruct its stabilizing traditions to include smaller and smaller numbers of people who do not or will not fit into the categories upon which even our perceptions are based. This is not a good thing. Each person's private trouble cannot be solved by a social revolution, because revolutions are destabilizing and dangerous. We have learned to live together and organize our complex societies slowly and incrementally over vast stretches of time, and we do not understand with sufficient exactitude why what we are doing works. Thus, altering our ways of social being carelessly in the name of some ideological shibboleth, diversity springs to mind, is likely to produce far more trouble than good, given the suffering that even small revolutions generally produce. Was it really a good thing, for example, to so dramatically liberalize the divorce laws in the 1960s? It's not clear to me that the children whose lives were destabilized by the hypothetical freedom this attempt at liberation introduced would say so. Horror and terror lurk behind the walls provided so wisely by our ancestors. We tear them down at our peril. We skate unconsciously on thin ice with deep, cold waters below, where unimaginable monsters lurk. I see today's parents as terrified by their children, not least because they have been deemed the proximal agents of this hypothetical social tyranny and simultaneously denied credit for their role as benevolent and necessary agents of discipline, order, and conventionality. They dwell uncomfortably and self-consciously in the all-too-powerful shadow of the adolescent ethos of the 1960s, a decade whose excesses led to a general denigration of adulthood, an unthinking disbelief in the existence of competent power, and the inability to distinguish between the chaos of immaturity and responsible freedom. This has increased parental sensitivity to the short-term emotional suffering of their children, while heightening their fear of damaging their children to a painful and counterproductive degree. Better this than the reverse, you might argue, but there are catastrophes lurking at the extremes of every moral continuum. The ignoble savage. It has been said that every individual is the conscious or unconscious follower of some influential philosopher. The belief that children have an intrinsically unsullied spirit, damaged only by culture and society, is derived in no small part from the 18th century Genevan French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau was a fervent believer in the corrupting influence of human society and private ownership alike. He claimed that nothing was so gentle and wonderful as man in his pre-civilized state. At precisely the same time, noting his inability as a father, he abandoned five of his children to the tender and fatal mercies of the orphanages of the time. The noble savage Rousseau described, however, was an ideal, an abstraction, archetypal and religious, and not the flesh and blood reality he supposed. The mythologically perfect divine child permanently inhabits our imagination. He's the potential of youth, the newborn hero, the wronged innocent, and the long-lost son of the rightful king. He's the intimations of immortality that accompany our earliest experiences. He's Adam, the perfect man, walking without sin with God in the garden before the fall. But human beings are evil as well as good, and the darkness that dwells forever in our souls is also there in no small part in our younger selves. In general, people improve with age rather than worsening, becoming kinder, more conscientious, and more emotionally stable as they mature. Bullying at the sheer and often terrible intensity of the schoolyard rarely manifests itself in grown-up society. William Golding's dark and anarchistic Lord of the Flies is a classic for a reason. Furthermore, there is plenty of direct evidence that the horrors of human behavior cannot be so easily attributed to history and society. This was discovered most painfully, perhaps, by the primatologist Jane Goodall, beginning in 1974, when she learned that her beloved chimpanzees were capable of and willing to murder each other, to use the terminology appropriate to humans. Because of its shocking nature and great anthropological significance, she kept her observations secret for years, fearing that her contact with the animals had led them to manifest unnatural behavior. Even after she published her account, many refused to believe it. It soon became obvious, however, that what she observed was by no means rare. Bluntly put, chimpanzees conduct intertribal warfare. Furthermore, they do it with almost unimaginable brutality. The typical full-grown chimp is more than twice as strong as a comparable human being, despite their smaller size. Goodall reported with some terror the proclivity of the chimps she studied to snap strong steel cables and levers. Chimps can literally tear each other to pieces, and they do. Human societies and their complex technologies cannot be blamed for that. "Often when I woke in the night," she wrote, "horrific pictures sprang unbidden to my mind. Satan, a long-observed chimp, cupping his hand below Sniff's chin to drink the blood that welled from a great wound in his face. Jomeo tearing a strip of skin from Day's thigh. Figgin charging and hitting again and again the stricken, quivering body of Goliath, one of his childhood heroes. Small gangs of adolescent chimps, mostly male, roam the borders of their territory. If they encounter foreigners, even chimps they once knew who had broken away from the now too large group, and if they outnumber them, the gang will mob and destroy them without mercy." Chimps don't have much of a superego, and it is prudent to remember that the human capacity for self-control may also be overestimated. Careful perusal of a book as shocking and horrific as Iris Chang's The Rape of Nanking, which describes the brutal decimation of that Chinese city by the invading Japanese, will disenchant even a committed romantic. And the less said about Unit 731, a covert Japanese biological warfare research unit established at that time, the better. Read about it at your peril. You have been warned. Hunter-gatherers, too, are much more murderous than their urban industrialized counterparts, despite their communal lives and localized cultures. The yearly rate of homicide in the modern UK is about 1 per 100,000. It's 4 to 5 times higher in the US and about 90 times higher in Honduras, which has the highest rate recorded of any modern nation. But the evidence strongly suggests that human beings have become more peaceful rather than less so as time has progressed and societies became larger and more organized. The Kung Bushmen of Africa, romanticized in the 1950s by Elizabeth Marshall Thomas as the harmless people, had a yearly murder rate of 40 per 100,000, which declined by more than 30% once they became subject to state authority. This is a very instructive example of complex social structures serving to reduce, not exacerbate, the violent tendencies of human beings. Yearly rates of 300 per 100,000 have been reported for the Yanomami of Brazil, famed for their aggression, but the stats don't max out there. The denizens of Papua New Guinea kill each other at yearly rates ranging from 140 to 1,000 per 100,000. However, the record appears to be held by the Cato, an indigenous people of California, 1,450 of whom, per 100,000, met a violent death circa 1840. Because children, like other human beings, are not only good, they cannot simply be left to their own devices, untouched by society, and bloom into perfection. Even dogs must be socialized if they are to become acceptable members of the pack, and children are much more complex than dogs. This means that they are much more likely to go complexly astray if they are not trained, disciplined, and properly encouraged. This means that it is not just wrong to attribute all the violent tendencies of human beings to the pathologies of social structure. It's wrong enough to be virtually backward. The vital process of socialization prevents much harm and fosters much good. Children must be shaped and informed, or they cannot thrive. This fact is reflected starkly in their behavior. Kids are utterly desperate for attention from both peers and adults because such attention, which renders them effective and sophisticated communal players, is vitally necessary. Children can be damaged as much or more by a lack of incisive attention as they are by abuse, mental or physical. This is damaged by omission rather than commission, but it is no less severe and long-lasting. Children are damaged when their mercifully inattentive parents fail to make them sharp and observant and awake and leave them instead in an unconscious and undifferentiated state. Children are damaged when those charged with their care, afraid of any conflict or upset, no longer dare to correct them and leave them without guidance. I can recognize such children on the street. They are doughy and unfocused and vague. They are leaden and dull instead of golden and bright. They are uncarved blocks trapped in a perpetual state of waiting to be. Such children are chronically ignored by their peers. This is because they are not fun to play with. Adults tend to manifest the same attitude, although they will deny it desperately when pressed. When I worked in daycare centers early in my career, the comparatively neglected children would come to me desperately in their fumbling, half-formed manner, with no sense of proper distance and no attentive playfulness. They would flop nearby or directly on my lap, no matter what I was doing. Driven inexorably by the powerful desire for adult attention, the necessary catalyst for further development. It was very difficult not to react with annoyance, even disgust, to such children and their too prolonged infantilism. Difficult not to literally push them aside, even though I felt very badly for them and understood their predicament well. I believe that response, harsh and terrible though it may be, was an almost universally experienced internal warning signal indicating the comparative danger of establishing a relationship with a poorly socialized child. The likelihood of immediate and inappropriate dependence, which should have been the responsibility of the parent, and the tremendous demand of time and resources that accepting such dependence would necessitate. Confronted with such a situation, potentially friendly peers and interested adults are much more likely to turn their attention to interacting with other children whose cost-benefit ratio, to speak bluntly, would be much lower. Parent or friend? The neglect and mistreatment that is part and parcel of poorly structured or even entirely absent disciplinary approaches can be deliberate, motivated by explicit, conscious, if misguided, parental motives. But more often than not, modern parents are simply paralyzed by the fear that they will no longer be liked or even loved by their children if they chastise them for any reason. They want their children's friendship above all and are willing to sacrifice respect to get it. This is not good. A child will have many friends, but only two parents, if that. And parents are more, not less, than friends. Friends have very limited authority to correct. Every parent, therefore, needs to learn to tolerate the momentary anger or even hatred directed towards them by their children, after necessary corrective action has been taken, as the capacity of children to perceive or care about long-term consequences is very limited. Parents are the arbiters of society. They teach children how to behave so that other people will be able to interact meaningfully and productively with them. It is an act of responsibility to discipline a child. It is not anger at misbehavior. It's not revenge for a misdeed. It is instead a careful combination of mercy and long-term judgment. Proper discipline requires effort, indeed, is virtually synonymous with effort. It is difficult to pay careful attention to children. It is difficult to figure out what is wrong and what is right and why. It is difficult to formulate just and compassionate strategies of discipline and to negotiate their application with others deeply involved in a child's care. Because of this combination of responsibility and difficulty, any suggestion that all constraints placed on children are damaging can be perversely welcome. Such a notion, once accepted, allows adults who should know better to abandon their duty to serve as agents of enculturation and pretend that doing so is good for children. It's a deep and pernicious act of self-deception. It's lazy, cruel, and inexcusable. And our proclivity to rationalize does not end there. We assume that rules will irremediably inhibit what would otherwise be the boundless and intrinsic creativity of our children, even though the scientific literature clearly indicates, first, that creativity beyond the trivial is shockingly rare, and second, that strict limitations facilitate rather than inhibit creative achievement. Belief in the purely destructive element of rules and structure is frequently conjoined with the idea that children will make good choices about when to sleep and what to eat if their perfect natures are merely allowed to manifest themselves. These are equally ungrounded assumptions. Children are perfectly capable of attempting to subsist on hot dogs, chicken fingers, and Fruit Loops if doing so will attract attention, provide power, or shield them from trying anything new. Instead of going to bed wisely and peacefully, children will fight nighttime unconsciousness until they are staggered by fatigue. They are also perfectly willing to provoke adults while exploring the complex contours of the social environment, just like juvenile chimps harassing the adults in their troops. Observing the consequences of teasing and taunting enables chimp and child alike to discover the limits of what might otherwise be a too unstructured and terrifying freedom. Such limits, when discovered, provide security, even if their detection causes momentary disappointment or frustration. I remember taking my daughter to the playground once when she was about 2. She was playing on the monkey bars, hanging in midair. A particularly provocative little monster of about the same age was standing above her on the same bar she was gripping. I watched him move towards her. Our eyes locked. He slowly and deliberately stepped on her hands with increasing force over and over as he stared me down. He knew exactly what he was doing. Up yours, daddy-o. That was his philosophy. He had already concluded that adults were contemptible and that he could safely defy them. Too bad, then, that he was destined to become one. That was the hopeless future his parents had saddled him with. To his great and salutary shock, I picked him bodily off the playground structure and threw him 30 feet down the field. No, I didn't. I just took my daughter somewhere else. But it would have been better for him if I had. Imagine a toddler repeatedly striking his mother in the face. Why would he do such a thing? It's a stupid question. It's unacceptably naive. The answer is obvious. To dominate his mother. To see if he can get away with it. Violence, after all, is no mystery. It's peace that's the mystery. Violence is the default. It's easy. It's peace that is difficult, learned, inculcated, earned. People often get basic psychological questions backwards. Why do people take drugs? Not a mystery. It's why they don't take them all the time that's the mystery. Why do people suffer from anxiety? That's not a mystery. How is it that people can ever be calm? There's the mystery. We're breakable and mortal. A million things can go wrong in a million ways. We should be terrified out of our skulls at every second. But we're not. The same can be said for depression, laziness, and criminality. If I can hurt and overpower you, then I can do exactly what I want, when I want, even when you're around. I can torment you to appease my curiosity. I can take the attention away from you and dominate you. I can steal your toy. Children hit first because aggression is innate, although more dominant in some individuals and less in others, and second, because aggression facilitates desire. It's foolish to assume that such behavior must be learned. A snake does not have to be taught to strike. It's in the nature of the beast. 2-year-olds, statistically speaking, are the most violent of people. They kick, hit, and bite, and they steal the property of others. They do so to explore, to express outrage and frustration, and to gratify their impulsive desires. More importantly, for our purposes, they do so to discover the true limits of permissible behavior. How else are they ever going to puzzle out what is acceptable? Infants are like blind people searching for a wall. They have to push forward and test to see where the actual boundaries lie, and those are too seldom where they are said to be. Consistent correction of such action indicates the limits of acceptable aggression to the child. Its absence merely heightens curiosity. So the child will hit and bite and kick if he is aggressive and dominant until something indicates a limit. How hard can I hit Mummy? Until she objects. Given that, correction is better sooner than later if the desired end result of the parent is not to be hit. Correction also helps the child learn that hitting others is a suboptimal social strategy. Without that correction, no child is going to undergo the effortful process of organizing and regulating their impulses so that those impulses can coexist without conflict within the psyche of the child and in the broader social world. It is no simple matter to organize a mind. My son was particularly ornery when he was a toddler. When my daughter was little, I could paralyze her into immobility with an evil glance. Such an intervention had no effect at all on my son. He had my wife, who is no pushover, stymied at the dinner table by the time he was 9 months of age. He fought her for control over the spoon. Good, we thought. We didn't want to feed him one more minute than necessary anyway. But the little blighter would only eat 3 or 4 mouthfuls. Then he would play. He would stir his food around in his bowl. He would drop bits of it over the high chair tabletop and watch as it fell on the floor below. No problem. He was exploring, but then he wasn't eating enough. Then, because he wasn't eating enough, he wasn't sleeping enough. Then his midnight crying was waking his parents. Then they were getting grumpy and out of sorts. He was frustrating his mother, and she was taking it out on me. The trajectory wasn't good. After a few days of this degeneration, I decided to take the spoon back. I prepared for war. I set aside sufficient time. A patient adult can defeat a 2-year-old, hard as that is to believe. As the saying goes, old age and treachery can always overcome youth and skill. This is partly because time lasts forever when you're 2. Half an hour for me was a week for my son. I assured myself of victory. He was stubborn and horrible, but I could be worse. We sat down, face to face, bowl in front of him. It was high noon. He knew it, and I knew it. He picked up the spoon. I took it from him and spooned up a delicious mouthful of mush. I moved it deliberately towards his mouth. He eyed me in precisely the same manner as the playground foot monster. He curled his lips downward into a tight frown, rejecting all entry. I chased his mouth around with the spoon as he twisted his head around in tight circles. But I had more tricks up my sleeve. I poked him in the chest with my free hand in a manner calculated to annoy. He didn't budge. I did it again, and again, and again. Not hard, but not in a manner to be ignored either. 10 or so pokes later, he opened his mouth, planning to emit a sound of outrage. Ha! His mistake. I deftly inserted the spoon. He tried gamely to force out the offending food with his tongue. But I know how to deal with that, too. I just placed my forefinger horizontally across his lips. Some came out, but some was swallowed, too. Score, 1 for Dad. I gave him a pat on the head and told him that he was a good boy, and I meant it. When someone does something you are trying to get them to do, reward them. No grudge after victory. An hour later, it was all over. There was outrage. There was some wailing. My wife had to leave the room. The stress was too much, but food was eaten by child. My son collapsed, exhausted, on my chest. We had a nap together, and he liked me a lot better when he woke up than he had before he was disciplined. This was something I commonly observed when we went head to head, and not only with him. A little later, we entered into a babysitting swap with another couple. All the kids would get together at one house. Then one pair of parents would go out to dinner or a movie and leave the other pair to watch the children, who were all under 3. One evening, another set of parents joined us. I was unfamiliar with their son, a large, strong boy of 2. "He won't sleep," said his father. "After you put him to bed, he will crawl out of his bed and come downstairs. We usually put on an Elmo video and let him watch it." There's no damn way I'm rewarding a recalcitrant child for unacceptable behavior, I thought, and I'm certainly not showing anyone any Elmo video. I always hated that creepy, whiny puppet. He was a disgrace to Jim Henson's legacy. So reward by Elmo was not on the table. I didn't say anything, of course. There's just no talking to parents about their children until they are ready to listen. 2 hours later, we put the kids to bed. 4 of the 5 went promptly to sleep, but not the Muppet aficionado. I had placed him in a crib, however, so he couldn't escape. But he could still howl, and that's exactly what he did. That was tricky. It was good strategy on his part. It was annoying, and it threatened to wake up all the other kids, who would then also start to howl. Score, 1 for the kid. So I journeyed into the bedroom. "Lie down," I said. That produced no effect. "Lie down," I said, "or I will lay you down." Reasoning with kids isn't often of too much use, particularly under such circumstances, but I believe in fair warning. Of course, he didn't lie down. He howled again, for effect. Kids do this frequently. Scared parents think that a crying child is always sad or hurt. This is simply not true. Anger is one of the most common reasons for crying. Careful analysis of the musculature patterns of crying children has confirmed this. Anger crying and fear or sadness crying do not look the same. They also don't sound the same and can be distinguished with careful attention. Anger crying is often an act of dominance and should be dealt with as such. I lifted him up and laid him down, gently, patiently, but firmly. He got up. I laid him down. He got up. I laid him down. He got up. This time I laid him down and kept my hand on his back. He struggled mightily, but ineffectually. He was, after all, only 1/10 my size. I could take him with one hand. So I kept him down and spoke calmly to him and told him he was a good boy and that he should relax. I gave him a soother and pounded gently on his back. He started to relax. His eyes began to close. I removed my hand. He promptly got to his feet. I was impressed. The kid had spirit. I lifted him up and laid him back down again. "Lie down, monster," I said. I pounded his back gently some more. Some kids find that soothing. He was getting tired. He was ready to capitulate. Closed his eyes. I got to my feet and headed quietly and quickly to the door. I glanced back to check his position one last time. He was back on his feet. I pointed my finger at him. "Down, monster," I said, and I meant it. He went down like a shot. I closed the door. We liked each other. Neither my wife nor I heard a peep out of him for the rest of the night. "How was the kid?" his father asked me when he got home, much later that night. "Good," I said. "No problem at all. He's asleep right now."
"Did he get up?"
said his father. "No," I said. "He slept the whole time." Dad looked at me. He wanted to know, but he didn't ask, and I didn't tell. Don't cast pearls before swine, as the old saying goes, and you might think that's harsh. But training your child not to sleep and rewarding him with the antics of a creepy puppet? That's harsh, too. You pick your poison, and I'll pick mine.